Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. On this week's episodes, In the Red Corner, the movie that set the standard for the buddy genre, as Paul Newman and Robert Redford go a running and a robbing as the Old West comes to an end in 1969's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Paul Newman is Butch Cassidy, and the Sundance Kid is Robert Redford. Catherine Ross is Etta Place. An incredible pair of rugged adventurers, creating a living legend on two continents.
But it's just one guy.
They were outlaws, running out of time and out of space, and a changing world was closing in on them. From the American West to New York.
While in the blue corner, our bickering buddy bonanza continues as Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis find themselves on the run across the southern states with the law hot on their tail. From 1991, we're talking Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise are going fishing.
How come Daryl let you go?
Because I didn't ask him.
He's gonna kill you!
I left him a note.
Thelma and Louise are going to catch hell.
I'll have a wild turkey straight up and a Coke back, please.
Thelma?
Oh, what? Tell me something. Is this my vacation or isn't it?
A little bit drink of margaritas by the sea, Mama Sita. Woo!
So what connects these two films and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Butters. I'm a grandmother and a female, and I've got my rights. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
And today, we are joined on Clash Pod by a very special guest. It's wonderful to have her in the studio. It's film critic, broadcaster, and host of the feminist film podcast, Girls on Film. She can also be seen currently presenting the BBC News film review show. It's the brilliant Anna Smith!
Hey!
Oh, thank you for the warm welcome. It's lovely to be here.
How are you, Anna?
I'm splendid, thank you. Life is good. Life is good.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know, we're finally getting out and about with Girls on Film. We've been on stage at Latitude Festival, which was very exciting. First time in several years with an audience. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, and I actually made it to Cannes as well this year. So getting out while being tested furiously, obviously.
Let me live vicariously through you for a moment. How was Cannes?
It was good, actually. A little bit quieter, but it was still quite exciting to be seeing movies on the big screen with lots of other people. And the weather was gorgeous because it was July, not May, like normally it rains. So actually, it was a really good Cannes in lots of ways. Yeah.
Amazing. Now, we mentioned, obviously, you and I have worked together on the Oscars panel two years in a row, which was a lot of fun. But Girls on Film, in case anyone hasn't listened to your amazing podcast, which they should, tell us a bit about it.
So it's a female-focused film podcast. We highlight female filmmakers and female female film critics in particular, but men are welcome if they made interesting films about women. We had Bo Burnham on, and we've had some great people like Linda Hamilton, Brie Larson, Amara Sante, and we kind of welcome newcomers and sort of old favourites, really. And we dissect things from a feminist point of view. One of our favourite episodes with the listeners was Tenet. We sat down and we deconstructed that, the female characters in that. And actually a lot of men came to us and said, that's made me think differently about that film. And I always take that as a compliment when men say, it's not just women listening to Girls on Film. The men say, okay, it's made me think about film differently. And I think that's the greatest compliment.
That's great. Well, if you haven't listened to Girls on Film, you absolutely should. It is a wonderful listen. So are you excited to be joining us for this pairing, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid versus Thelma and Louise?
I'm very excited. I was thrilled to be asked. You know, I'm not going to reveal my thoughts on the various two yet, obviously, but I think they are a valid pairing and I can see why you've put them together. And I think there's a lot to discuss.
While I'd love to take credit for putting them together, these choices were V's choices. Tell us you're working out, Victoria.
So these choices were kind of Chris's choices. No, I'm only joking. I really wanted to do Thelma and Louise and have done for ages because it's one of my favourite films, but I just couldn't figure out what to pair it with. But because Chris knows everything about film, you did put these two together. Like, it's obvious when you said it, but it did. I think it took us quite a long while to come to it.
Yeah, we talked about Bonnie and Clyde. We talked about Sightseers, which I'm desperate to do. Yeah. And then, but then with the endings, and then when you watch them back to back, there are a lot of similarities. It does make sense. Yeah.
Well, we have some interesting guesses about what our listeners think Thelma and Louise could have been paired with. But remind us of the clue you gave last week.
Friends till the end.
What was that expression?
I forgot.
Friends till the end. You followed that up on Twitter with...
I had a really good clue, but it was too similar to yours, but I want to say it now.
Go on.
Chums on the Run.
That's good.
You can run, but you can't hide.
So we're on Twitter at ClashPod, also on Instagram at ClashPod. And the guesses came steaming in faster than the Pacific Flyer. A lot of guesses involving Thelma and Louise. Tim Wilkins and Kirsten Ellen Young said Thelma and Louise versus Monster. Mm-hmm. A few of those. Danny Baker, Thelma and Louise versus Nuns on the Run.
Chums on the Run.
Mm. And Ruari Smythe, Thelma and Louise versus The Running Man. Okay, but congratulations to our only correct guest this week. Yeah, you love it, don't you? What does it mean if only one person gets it right?
We got the clues were perfect.
Clues.
Not too easy, not too hard.
Congratulations. I think I always say this, and you always go, they've won previously. Rich Cracknell, first time winner, I think. Congratulations to you. Let's do the connection section. What have you got?
Armed robbery.
Did you notice any connections between these two?
Well, there are some obvious ones which you'll probably get into, but I think the fact that Brad Pitt looks like a lot like Robert Redford.
My God, he's identical.
Oh, that's a good point.
I think that's a deliberate casting move. And he rocks in with a cowboy hat and he is a robber.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cowboy robbers got that. Death.
I mean, a lot of films have death in them. Try and get it more specific, Alex.
Okay, freeze frames on slightly ambiguous deaths, but definitely death, but maybe not death. Mm. Who knows?
Who knows? Photographs. So the photo montage and the Polaroids in Thelma and Louise.
Polite robberies.
Yeah.
These are the politest thieves in history, aren't they? Lots of things like friendship, outlaws. As the end approaches in both films, both characters start planning their futures. It's quite sad.
Yes, pretending that everything's going to be fine.
Yeah,
deluding themselves and each other. Yeah.
So I have questions about that, which I'll say for the end of Butch Cassidy, but I do have questions about that exact subject. Both won the Best Screenplay Award at the Oscars. Mm-hmm. Any more?
We're getting to the behind the scenes, but it's interesting, I think, that in both cases, Paul Newman for Butch and Gina Davis for Thelma and Louise, they both flip-flopped on who they would be playing. So we could have got versions of both these films where they played the other character and they weren't sure which character they should play.
Okay. I did not know that.
We'll get into it.
All right then. So, if you're ready, shall we get into this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, on Thursday, Chris is doing the show and it's going to drop off a cliff as he takes us through Thelma and Louise, which means today I'm asking, who are those guys in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? Let me take you on a journey. Butch and Sundance have made a good living as career criminals. Butch is the brains and Sundance is the brawn. They are also very beautiful. And I spent a lot of this film trying to figure out who I fancied more. Anyway, as the Old West starts to disappear, modernization makes their Robin more difficult. And they find themselves in a sticky situation when the most badass posse ever formed is paid to hunt them down. They can't be reasoned with. They can't be bargained with. and they absolutely will not stop. They're cowboy Terminators, which genuinely is a better pitch than the last three Terminator movies. Anyway, Butch and Sundance escape to Bolivia, along with Sundance's gal, Etta, who thankfully remembers not to whine or make a nuisance, so she doesn't get dumped flat. She does fulfill her promise, though, to piss off home before our duo get gunned down by the Bolivian army and die. Or, if you're the nine-year-old me, definitely didn't die because you don't actually see them die, and so they definitely escape somehow because you can't have movies where your heroes die. What the fuck's wrong with you? Ladies and gentlemen, for your consideration, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So, histories with this movie. Anna, would you like to start? When did you first see this movie?
Actually, probably only about 10 years ago. Okay. I didn't see it when I was young. I didn't see it as a kid. It's not the kind of film that I studied or that I grew up with, so I didn't have more associations other than sort of seeing it fleetingly on TV, the sort of thing, you know, the Sunday afternoon. So I did watch it in seriousness and sort of sat down 10 years ago. And I was a little bit underwhelmed, I've got to say, because wow. Maybe it's coming to it later. You know, obviously when you, as you were saying, if you were 9 years old and you're watching that, you have a lot of excitement, a lot of associations. Mm. But I didn't like the characters very much, so I had quite a few problems with that.
Butch and Sundance?
Not particularly. They treat people horribly. Except for each other.
Interesting.
So I therefore wasn't really invested in their fate.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I can see that if you were invested in them, it would be very emotional at the ending. But I just wasn't invested in them because I thought they were pretty arrogant and they made some very foolish decisions. Obviously, there are some great moments, which we'll get into. And I did find it reasonably amusing in parts. Mm. But I do think it's overhyped. And I think it's interesting that when it first came out, it was not that well reviewed.
Mm.
And then it became a bit of a cult hit. So I felt like I'm more in line with the early reviews. If I'd been sent that to review for a column this week, I would go 3 stars.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you're absolutely right. Was it Pauline Kael, the famous reviewer, said she felt depressed and rather offended after reviewing a facetious empty Western. And Time went further and called it absurd and anachronistic.
It's interesting on the documentaries on the Blu-rays and DVDs. They've got some critics who reviewed it poorly at the time, looking at it now, analysing it now, and saying they like it now more than they did then. And a couple of people say they were offended by the fact that it was like taking the piss out of Westerns, and that they considered Westerns to be a very pure form of art, and that this sort of postmodern take on the genre was something they were offended by at the time. And with the distance of time now, they were like, no, I had that wrong, actually. It did kind of put a full stop on the Western, but I like what they were doing. I just didn't understand it at the time.
So when did you see it?
Well, my mum loves Cary Grant and Paul Newman.
Mm.
So I grew up on Cary Grant and Paul Newman films. So yeah, I saw this when I was a kid.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Remember enjoying it?
Yep.
Like how old though? Only because I know exactly how old I was when I saw it.
I don't know how old I was. 6, 7, 8.
Okay, yeah, so young,
really,
young.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a bit boring in the middle, but like the beginning and end.
Okay.
Like an 8-year-old.
B?
I saw it at college, so Mark made me watch it, and I didn't want to watch it.
It was definitely on his VHS shelf, this.
Yeah, because Mark's mum loves Paul Newman, so I was like, I'm not watching this mum film, like, not in a million years. And so I had the reverse experience to you, Anna, because my expectations were so low. So I was like, I don't want to watch it. It's going to be boring. And then I was laughing. But because, like you're saying about not being invested in the characters, when they go to rob the flyer, if I was coming to it fresh, I'd be like, why do I care what you get up to? Like, there's nothing in it for me at this point with your characters. But because I was like, oh, I'm actually quite enjoying this, that gets away with it. So the lore of the film added to my enjoyment of it because I knew it was a big deal. I didn't realise how poorly it was reviewed until I looked into it this week, but I knew it was this like juggernaut thing. So that's why I enjoyed it, because it was better than I thought it was going to be. Shit. And it's not. So there we go.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's like 1969 and it made 102 million, biggest film of that year. Audiences absolutely loved it. I watched it when I was 9 years old, and again, because my mum loved Paul Newman, and she was like, you've got to see this new movie, Paul Newman's in it. And I do remember watching it at 9 years old and not really getting Robert Redford, not finding him cool at all.
I agree, yeah.
But thinking Paul Newman as Butch Cassidy was the coolest character I'd ever seen.
Mm. And that stayed with me, though. Paul Newman's my guy.
Yeah, it's weird. And I was like, I thought, because I was trying to work out what it was about Robert Redford's character that made me, as a 9-year-old, go, I don't think you're cool. And I think it was the moustache. I don't think any of my heroes that I was watching on screen.
But
well,
Reynolds.
That's it. That's the only
just
one.
Just undermined your argument.
Yeah, I know, which is the only one that I can think of. The Bandit had a moustache, so it can't have been the Tash. But yeah, I remembered 3 things from it. I remembered the jump off the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered the bicycle montage for some reason.
Yeah, I always remember that one.
Because it goes on for so bloody long.
It really does.
And that song. And I do remember the end.
because I genuinely was like, they didn't die. They will have escaped somehow. That's why they didn't show the death. If unless you die on screen, you're not actually dead, despite the repeated gunshots over the photograph. All right, then. I'll tell you a little bit about this movie. I'll try and get through this. God, there was a lot. So, author and screenwriter William Goldman first comes across the real-life story of Butch Cassidy in the 50s and does about 8 years of research because there is no internet. So he actually has to read books and find articles, which is why it took him 8 years. He wasn't sure what he was going to do with it because he wasn't sure if he wanted to do a novel or a screenplay, but he knew that this story was amazing. And he thought it was amazing because of this theme of Butch and Sundance doing the thing that everyone really wants to do in life, apparently, according to William Goldman, which is recapture their golden years. And they actually do it. They have a whole second life in Bolivia where they become more famous than they were in the US. So in the end, he decides, I'm going to do it as a screenplay because he couldn't do a novel. Because he said to make a Western novel, first of all, he didn't like Western novels. I've never read a Western novel. Have any of you read Western novels? Not a single one in my life.
Oh, no. You know, I always go on, I accidentally read Cormac McCarthy's The Blood Meridian on holiday.
How did you accidentally read it?
I didn't realise what was in it. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of like hiding in the stomachs of dead cows and there's a lot of scalping in it. And I was on a beach and it wasn't suitable. So I read that. Mm. That's a Western, kind of. Mm.
I've never read one.
I wouldn't be inclined to.
And don't do it on holiday.
Well, he doesn't say whether it was on a holiday or not. He said he couldn't write a novel because you have to make it authentic. And to make it authentic, you've had to do more research. And he's shit scared of horses. He couldn't go near a horse. Really? And so he felt that he needed to be near horses to write it. So he turns it into his first original screenplay. And he writes it, finishes writing it in 1968. It wasn't well received by the studios because of this third act in Bolivia. And he took it to the studios. And everyone was like, this is just not what a Western can be. And he says it's because Butch and Sundance do what no character in a Western would ever do and ran away. They run away from the posse to Bolivia. And all the studio execs were like, no, absolutely not. They've got to stay. A, you've got to stay in the Old West. And B, they have to have a gunfight with this posse that's chasing them. Or as one exec put it, I don't give a shit if it actually happened. All I know is one thing, John Wayne, don't run away. So that was the feeling about it. At this point, it was called The Sundance Kid and Butch Cassidy. And it got changed when Paul Newman goes, I'll join it, but I'll play Butch Cassidy. And so I think it's probably going to be called Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It was I didn't realise this, highest amount ever paid for a screenplay. It was George Zanuck was given $200,000 to spend on a new script. And his agent, or rather William Goldman's agent, managed to get him $400,000.
Wow.
The equivalent in today's money of £2.8 million for this screenplay. And obviously, Paul Newman gets attached. He was the only person that anyone had in mind. He'd had loads of success with Cool Hand Luke. So he comes in and he's Butch Cassidy. And then they struggle a bit to find the Sundance Kid. They offered it to Jack Lemmon, who said, I don't want to ride a horse again, and so turned it down. Have you ever ridden a horse?
Yes.
It's terrifying.
It is quite scary.
Do you do a lot of riding?
No, I don't do a lot. Okay. No, I'm not a big fan. But I'm wondering why everyone involved in this does seem to be adverse to horses in this story. I'm just wondering.
Yeah.
It's pretty ironic, isn't it?
It's so strange. Have you been on a horse?
I have, yeah. Well, she's unbelievable.
You can't picture me on a horse. No, never.
You've been on a horse, Alex.
It's not coming on your upbringing. You didn't have the kind of life that would lead you to a horse.
You wouldn't think it to listen to me, but I managed to sneak onto a horse once.
I can't now. Now I know you're lying. I can't imagine you sneaking onto a horse.
Go.
Yeah, I got on a horse once, and having watched a lot of movies with horses in, I was like, just fucking riding a horse, it's easy. Got on it, terrifying. Mm. You're so high up and it's an animal between your legs that you can't control. If you're me, just does its own thing.
Control the animal between your legs, Alex.
I've just remembered this. Who were those two cleaners? They did a show on Channel 4. There was the larger lady had blonde hair and she was on Big Brother.
Oh, Thingy. The How Clean, Aggie. And, yeah.
Aggie.
Yeah.
So she was the one on Big Brother. We were making a show about bird watching for Sky and she was on it. And like, I mean, she really could have sued the producers because they put her on a horse and she was terrified. She didn't want to be on it and couldn't control it. And the horse walked straight into a low branch of a tree and she was left hanging on this branch as the horse carried on walking and had to be rescued from the branch like a comedy film.
No.
It was.
How long
really
was she up there?
Too long for it to be comfortable and funny.
Wow. It's quite strong, though. To... Yeah,
she held on. It's quite high up. I just totally forgot about that. Anyway, it was Paul Newman's wife who suggests Redford. And I didn't realise, again, this was like the breakthrough role for Redford.
He'd done Barefoot in the Park. And so he became known as sort of a preppy comedy guy. But no one, he wasn't a household name. And yeah, no one, well, particularly Daryl Zanuck didn't think he could, is it Daryl or Richard Zanuck?
Richard Zanuck.
Didn't think he could cut it as a cowboy. Just wouldn't buy this clean cut blonde dude.
Yeah, he wanted Steve McQueen. But Robert Redford says, George, the director, went to the mat for me. They kept forcing him to look at other candidates, but eventually they ran out of other actors. So yeah, Redford gets it. And McQueen was sort of really interested in being in it, but he disagreed over who should get top billing.
That happens a lot with McQueen. Because that's why I think Taring Inferno, they're kind of diagonally the two names, Newman and McQueen, so that one name and first name and last name's first. But yeah, Zanuck said that they just had these awful, ridiculous meetings where he literally he had a globe and said, 50% you'll be first billing and 50% of the world you'll be first billing, and yet still they couldn't agree on it, these two.
Which 50% of the world?
These two egos. Yeah. And he said, oh, we'll have a wheel that'll turn with your names on it, and it's just like, it was so ridiculous that in the end he just walked away. And Brando was going to do it, but all they said was Brando was going to do it, and then he disappeared. Very Marlon Brando.
So yeah, they only ever made two films together, Newman and Redford, this and The Sting. They were, I didn't know that it was A Walk in the Woods. It was going to be Robert Redford and Paul Newman again, but sadly, obviously, Paul Newman passed away at that point, which is why eventually Nick Nolte steps into that role. So, yeah, pretty much that's about it, unless you've got anything you'd really like to add to the background of this film.
No.
It's quite sweet. I love the director, George Roy Hill. He said after he'd finished it and it was about to be released, it was a hell of a lot of hard work doing it. And I actually had even more fun than I did work. And if audiences don't dig it, I think I'm going to go out of my fucking mind.
Which was the audio clip I was going to play.
Oh, really?
It's very
play
funny.
It anyway. He'll do it better.
It's very funny when he's...
We need to talk more before each episode.
I have now spent exactly a year and 3 months on this film. And at this point, I don't know yet how it's going to be received. I think it's a good film. I think the guys are great in it. And I think the relationships work. It was a hell of a lot of hard work doing it. And actually, even more fun. And if the audiences don't take it, I think I'll go out of my fucking mind.
They kind of drown him out with the piano, but you can just say, fucking mind. Here, up the piano, up, higher.
And that's the last line in the whole documentary.
Brilliant. It's refreshingly honest, isn't it, actually? I've never had a director talk like that in an interview.
This is a documentary from about 1970, 1971. So it's not like modern documentaries. And I've got some quotes from him, not the audio, but just he swears a lot on this and he's brutally honest. Some of it is quite uncomfortable to hear, but it's just quite refreshing.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into the film. I will say one thing, because I'm going to talk about the script a lot. William Goldman, I found a quote from him. Obviously, you know, double Oscar winner, one for All the President's Men, one for this. He says, if you only write screenplays, it is ultimately denigrating to the soul. You may get lucky and get rich, but you sure won't get happy.
Wow.
Mm.
You may get lucky, I'm going to get rich. You probably won't. That should be the end of that.
Right then. So let's talk about the opening sequence of this movie. Well, let's talk about the titles first and what looks like authentic newsreel footage of Butch and Sundance and the Hole in the Wall gang robbing the train. Interestingly, that was pulled from a later scene in the movie and moved to the start. I'll talk about it when it comes up, but they wanted to use it somehow, but it was actually going to be in the Bolivia sequence where Butch and Sundance are watching that footage. But we'll get to that. So we're outside a bank and then we're inside a bank as Butch is casing this bank. And this is a great, efficient opening where the entire theme of this movie is stated in three freaking lines, which is kind of amazing. He says, "What was the matter with the old bank this town used to have? It was beautiful. People kept robbing it. That's a small price to pay for beauty." What do you guys think of this opening in terms of this theme in this film, which runs throughout, of the world is changing and you have to change with them if you want to survive? Vicky.
Are you picking me?
I thought I'd go around in a clockwise fashion, yeah.
Well, that was such an interesting point, Alex. Thank you for throwing it over to me. And I would say, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with you that the film of the dauntless, faceless march of progress is summed up in this opening. But when you watch it for the first time, you kind of miss that, because what you like is, oh, that's a cool thing to say.
Yes.
So you're not like, wow, yeah, the march of capitalism. But later on, it's obviously hammered home by the fact that the gang arrive on a very advanced steam train and that they've got torches on their horses. And that's when the theme sort of clicks into place. For me, anyway, having only seen this two times. But first time around, I was like, wow, you're so cool and handsome.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that last line. You know, it's a small price to pay for beauty. But William Goldman hates it. He says it's too smart ass. I mean,
a lot of it.
Yeah, he says that about the whole film. He says there's too much smart assery in the script. But as we know from previous episodes, Serenity, Captain Mal, fucking love a smart ass. Yeah. So it suits me down to the ground. Chris, did you enjoy this?
Yes. I'm like Vicky, I wasn't really focusing on that. I was just trying to figure out how Paul Newman's eyes could be so blue that I could see the blue through the black and white. I'm sure I could.
Yeah.
It's magic. It's a magic trick he's done.
He's so beautiful. So this is the introduction to the theme of the film, and now we meet Sundance in this card game. Again, like, didn't get Sundance as a 9-year-old. Now, looking at him, captivating.
Yeah. Can I ask? I know it's jumping ahead a bit, so Chris is going to... But we've got a guest, so I'll get away with it because he won't embarrass...
Yeah. publicly shame you, yeah.
Yeah, in front of our friend. Mm. So when you were 9 and you don't quite get Robert Redford, how do you feel about him later when he goes to Etta's house? Did you get that scene or did you not understand what was going on?
I didn't remember that scene first time round.
All right.
I was watching it this time and it's interesting. I mean, because it was fresh to me, I was watching it going, he's not that guy. So yeah. this is your classic switch and bait.
Okay.
Bait and switch.
Yes.
Why?
Just because for me, I'd forgotten about it, but it goes on such a long time. Mm. So it's a really brave choice, but you do spend like 2 minutes thinking that one of your heroes is a rapist. And that's odd.
Do you though?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a big problem with that scene. I mean, it's barely to say that, but I think the very fact that it's being set up as a joke, I'm sorry, rape is not funny. And the fact that this is meant to be hilarious, that you've been lured into thinking that he's about to rape someone at gunpoint. And then, oh, she's with him anyway, and she acquiesces. And then also it's sexualized, you know, that whole thing is eroticized. Mm. So it's very much from a kind of leery male point of view that he's asking her to undress. So just because it's then, oh, we're only joking, I think that just makes it quite sickening.
It's a long time to say to your audience, this is who this guy is.
And
how is that for you?
I guess in the filmmakers' heads, they were going, but the longer that you do it for, but that's what they will have been doing. It's the longer you do it for, the more you sort of lure people into going, really? And then in theory, the old switcheroo at the end is meant to be like, oh, you get a bigger response.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that's why I think it goes on for that length of time. So, we have jumped ahead. Classic Vicky, but that's fine. That's fine. I'm glad we got there already.
Good.
So this card game, though, this is what a fantastic introduction for Sundance. It's the moment that Butch says his name, I can't help you, Sundance. And it's the card player, the guy who stood up. It's the expression on his face. He sells the shit out of the word Sundance because he just goes from being this badass to like that flash of sheer terror on his face and that blink he does. Really good. And so we've been told that Sundance is the best STEM gunslinger in the West, fastest draw, but we obviously have to see it, which we do. It's quite good. I mean, he shoots a guy's belt off.
Yeah, reading up on a lot of the history of this, there seems to be contrasting accounts. Most historians say there's no real evidence to suggest that Sundance was an incredible marksman, apart from the members of his family who've written books about him, who all say that he was the fastest gun in the West and
quicker than a snake's tongue is what one of them.
Mm. I mean, you kind of would do though, wouldn't you? Like,
yeah, no, that's what I'm saying.
We want
funny.
You to write a book about. He's actually really normal and a bit of a shit shot. Right, we don't want you to write a book anymore. Oh no, 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 sorry. Did I say shit? No, he was amazing.
A similar thing happened with Butch Cassidy's sister, who went. He didn't die.
Yeah, I read that this morning.
He's definitely alive.
But then they did dig up the corpses behind the bank that is meant to be them two,
Saint Vincent,
and it's not them two. Yeah. Or something.
She visited the set. Mm. She was at the premiere, and she made up the fact that he was alive and came back to America and lived with them and lived this life simply because she wasn't getting any money from the make of this film. So she decided just to get herself a bit of fame and attention. And I think it's brilliant.
Mm. Yeah.
She's about 90 at the time, just going around making up all these
shit. Yeah, he's in my house now.
She wrote a whole book, said he came to visit his sick father. She said he was driving a brand new silver Ford. He turns up, and then they interviewed other members of the Cassidy family, and they said the book was, and I quote, a pack of lies. They weren't making any money off it, you see. So we meet Sundance, and then we're off to the Hole in the Wall. This is a real place, the Hole in the Wall. That's where they got their name. It's a canyon, a really well-guarded canyon, which is where the real-life Hole in the Wall gang actually hung out. They were the last big outlaw gang of the Old West, led by Butch Cassidy. Not because he was tough, strong, ruthless, or even the brains, because apparently the real-life Butch Cassidy was massively likable. Like, right. People loved him. Like, he could ride up to people and go, I'm being chased by the law. Will you hide me? And they'd be like, you're Butch Cassidy. Yeah. Which is what we actually get to see when the train pulls up and the driver goes, that's Butch Cassidy. Yeah. And that's it. That was the reaction people had to him. He was like a really charming human. As we see in his introduction, when Logan tries to usurp him as leader of the Hole in the Wall, the Hole in the Wall gang.
Ted Cassidy as Logan.
So good.
I had to look him up. Did you recognise him? The big guy.
I knew him from something. Fill me in.
He's Lurch in the Addams Family.
No!
Yes! Oh my God, of course he is.
Yes.
That's so annoying.
And he's got that ridiculous deep voice. It's his voice you hear in the opening credits of every episode of The Incredible Hulk, explaining what happened to Banner in the lab.
Really?
Yeah. So two big bits of my childhood was this guy.
So I absolutely love this whole sequence. The bit where he goes, look, I don't want to be a sore loser, but if when it's over, if I'm dead, kill him. And Sundance goes, loved her. And it's the wave that Robert Redford, that smile and the wave he gives Logan is just, it's just the most beautiful thing.
Shit-eating grin, I think they call it.
So, this is a great introduction. There was a big dispute between Goldman and Hill with the producers, because the producers felt that in this sequence, they needed to have Sundance go, look, if it gets bad, I'll help you out. They needed something that suggested that Sundance was there to help Butch. And Goldman was like, absolutely not. What cements this relationship as being something different? Because he had this belief that these characters needed to be really likable, which is why it's interesting that you didn't like them. Because his whole thing was they need to be likable and they need to be so interesting and so unique to what we've seen before that you will follow them everywhere and anywhere, which is why when we get to Bolivia, which is such a curveball for a film like this, people will still be like, I don't care. I'm with them. And he was like, the fact that Butch doesn't ask for help and Sundance doesn't offer it is the key to this whole scene. And they won in the end. It's just great. Just great. If you can't tell already, I absolutely love this film. I just can't get how you can't like them.
Well, I agree with what you're saying about the scene, that it establishes their characters well. Mm. I think it's effective in that regard. And I think it's much more interesting. I think that was the right decision to make for that scene, because it establishes them as both very independent people, but who have a great relationship regardless. But I still felt that they were very self-centered throughout the film. And obviously, a lot of that does have something to do with the way they treat women. You know, this is obviously a way I'm going to come to a lot of angles, hosting the podcast that I do. But I think, you know, at least 50% of the population watching the film would feel the same way, if not more. And we can go into that more later. But I think that's a big part of it for me. But also, you know, the way they don't seem to be very remorseful about shooting people. In general.
I mean, it's just a waste of resource. Like, they're a gang, they're a unit, and he's saying to Sundance, if I die, make sure he dies too. And then, like, look, almost half your gang's gone. And after all the training and all the camaraderie, that to me seems like a flippant waste of resources.
But do you think they had outlaw training?
Well, yeah, a little bit. Do you know what I think?
don't know. I think it was more like,
right?
Are you capable
of
killing
someone? And then they
ran
her at a law branch and said, if you fall off that branch, you're not in the gang. That's what they did.
That was the show we were doing.
It was the show. It wasn't bird watching.
Yeah. If someone killed Alex, would you not kill them?
If it was you, yeah.
And let's be honest, it probably would be me.
Yeah, so I'm ready. Whenever you want to go, I'm ready.
At the end of a particularly dramatic verdict.
Yeah. Feels horribly real. Real, really, really real. What I love about this 8 years of research that William Goldman did, like little bits of the screenplay that you go, that's kind of fun and cool and funny, was just ripped from reality. Like News Carver, when he's like, goes, wait, I want to get to the best bit, and reads his own name out from the clipping. The guy was called News. He was a real member of the Hole in the Wall gang. He was called News because he was loved. He loved seeing his name in clippings. And so that he's just gone, I'll put that in the script. Research.
Yeah.
Research.
It's
research,
amazing.
Research. Yeah. So next section, the good train robbery. They rob the Pacific Flyer the first time. It's all going well. We have a wonderful exchange with Woodcock. Charles Woodcock, a real person. Again, all based on fact. He wouldn't let them in. And they did blow it up with dynamite, and he did survive and get injured. But he was like very, very loyal to E.H. Harriman. So the robbery's a success. Let's meet Etta. So we're over with Catherine Ross playing Etta. Now, we've touched on this. I wrote, it's your classic bait and switch scene.
Is it? Is it your classic? You see this all the time.
Yeah. But it's that reversal. It's not your classic. I mean, the structure of it is the classic. It's like the whole when they're about to jump off the cliff scene. It's the same thing. It starts with him going, we can make it, we can make it, we can make it. I can't swim. What are you talking about? The fall all killers. It's that whole reversal thing.
Uh-huh.
But you didn't like him.
I don't like it, no.
Chris, you've stayed very quiet on this subject.
Yeah, well, we hadn't got to that bit yet.
We're here now.
I felt like, first time I watched it, it's a bit shocking. And then the more I thought about it, trying to get into William Goldman's head, I felt like he was thinking, well, why would this school teacher... Well, he's sort of doing a sex scene between these two characters. Why would this? What would this school teacher and this cold-blooded killer do behind closed doors? What would their sex life be like? And I felt like in his head it was like, well, it would be a bit of role play because why else would you go out with this dangerous killer if you're a sweet, innocent teacher? And so that's where I thought he was coming from. I mean, I think it's interesting that he decided that she should be a school teacher because most of the evidence points to her being a sex worker in real life. And as I say, there's some uncomfortable quotes on that documentary. Goldman says he thought she was too pretty to be a hooker because there's one photograph of Etta or Ethel, and she's people say her real name is. And so he just thought with a face like that, she couldn't have possibly been a sex worker. And so he made her a school teacher. And again, the family of Sundance believe that she wasn't a sex worker as well. They've got all kinds of stories about what she was, who she was, but the historians seem to think that she probably was.
Well, there's some theories that she's actually, there were two identities. She was actually like a farm worker that he had an affair with when she was younger. And then they've got these two pictures, if you look it up on the internet, and these two women that do look remarkably similar.
Right.
And there's this whole conspiracy theory that they're both the same person.
Right, yeah, because that's what they say. She's a farm worker.
Right.
She's the daughter of someone that owned land and that. So, yeah, it's interesting that they're all these different. But I think it's surprising that Goldman took that decision, really, when he's based so much of it in reality, but he couldn't bear to have this character be that kind of person.
Yeah, I mean, the way you do it now, or to make it palatable, is the when people do the bait and switch with a couple, it's we've met for the first time and sorry, is this seat taken? And that's really cute. But whatever the truth is, when you're watching this film for the first time, it's sold to you as a buddy movie. The pollster says something about they're taking one piece of baggage, which I think is her in the pollster, which is not good.
Is that the tagline?
Yeah,
no,
it's like two buddies, one trip of a lifetime, and they're taking one piece of baggage.
Wow.
And it's either a horse or it's her. So whatever.
The baggage, not the people coming after them?
Possibly, but the way that the position of the text is next to her on the poster. So fine. But because it's portrayed as a buddy movie, you're supposed to like the characters, you're supposed to like them, and you're supposed to like them equally, I think, at this point. So it's fair to say that Sundance is also your hero. So you're watching your hero rape someone for like over 2 minutes, and then you're supposed to laugh, and it's like that's just such a lot to take in. And then you're supposed to like course correct yourself and think, oh, but I'm with you, I'll go to Bolivia with you, Sundance, no problem, as the audience. And it's a little bit difficult, even though Etta's character she seems to be into it, so you're supposed to forgive him. You spend a really uncomfortable amount of time thinking he's something that he isn't, and that, like you said, that's played for laughs, and that's all a bit hard to swallow.
Yeah, I think that was the first point in which I started to sort of turn against the film, you know, quite strongly, and against him as a character, because obviously I don't think there's much coming back from that, even if it's being set up that way and you know it's a joke. You just feel actually slightly resentful of the filmmakers for playing that trick, because it's not a very nice trick. And also, as I said, it is all from the male point of view. We've seen plenty of those films where the couple have the sex games, you know, the burglar fantasy, all that, you know, from both points of view, or from the woman's point of view. The fact that it was so much from his point of view and trying to trick the viewer, I thought made me really uncomfortable.
Yes, because you're supposed to say, I wonder what's going to happen next. And that's a bit gross when you think about it.
Mm. And on that note, let's take a short break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hi everyone, Marcus from the Football Ramble here. We know that keeping up with all the football can be quite a tricky task, even for those at the top of the game.
Wayne Rooney says he's been sleeping in his office.
Yep.
Diligent.
Get
dedicated.
Some signings.
Get signings.
Get some signings done. Because everything's done by fax, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he can't go home.
I like my dinner in the dog. That's actually how I eat my food these days.
Even those who run the clubs are having a mare.
I guess the system they have at Barcelona is that someone can come in and be president for a bit, and the destruction they leave is someone else's problem.
Thankfully, there's an easier way for you to keep up with all the football this season. Listen to the Football Ramble every weekday for the biggest stories from the Premier League and around the world. From the sublime to the ridiculous, the bust-ups to the cock-ups, it's your definitive guide to the new season. Just search Football Ramble in your podcast app to listen now.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Okay, we're back, and now it's time for the bad train robbery where things go wrong. The Woodcock repeat is wonderful. In real life, sadly, it's not quite as entertaining. He just opened the door.
I thought you could say he just died.
No.
Oh,
no.
Just killed him.
When it was Woodcock the second time, they went, open the door. Do you want to get blown up again? And the door was already open. He was like, fuck that.
No.
Yeah. So his loyalty only went so far. But we meet, and I'm never going to get bored of saying this word, the super posse. It's my new favourite word. There's a super posse who are introduced in ominous fashion. That terrifying train that turns up and then the doors open and they're already on horseback. It's great. And the fact that you never see their faces.
Yeah.
It's such a nice touch.
And they misname them a few times. And so it's Lord,
Lord Baltimore.
Baltimore. And then Joe, whoever it is.
Joe LaForge. So Joe LaForge was a real lawman in real life who was paid by E.H. Harriman, the train company owner, who did feel picked on by Butch Cassidy. He was like, why are you robbing my trains? So he paid for the super posse to get together. Lord Baltimore, the Native American who's taken a Western name, wasn't real. That was William Goldman's creation.
I feel like the super posse, the way they're shot in this film and presented, it reminded me, I feel like they influenced Peter Jackson with the Black Riders in Lord of the Rings.
Mm.
You know, just the focusing on the hooves and seeing in the distance coming. And
certainly that chase at the end of Fellowship when they're chasing Liv Tyler to the Ford of Bruin. It's a lot like that. Yeah. In real life, again, this is where it's a beautiful meld of fact and fiction. Because in real life, the minute Butch heard that a super posse had been formed, fucked off to Bolivia. He didn't wait to be chased. They never caught him. They never found him. They never even chased him. He was already in Bolivia by the time they were like, right, where is he?
Yeah, because, you know, the chase does go on too long. I believe it's 27 minutes. But, you know, Goldman's reasoning for that is that he couldn't just show them running off. So he wanted to build up this time and this chase and this sort of immovable object coming at them, because he believed the audience would then, after those 27 minutes, forgive our heroes for running away because there's no choice at that point. I think you could have done it in 10 minutes, but...
Really? I think it goes on the perfect length of time. For me, this is one of the strongest sequences of the whole film. This chase, I was really tense throughout. The fact that they go on to rock and they're like, they can't track us on rock and then they can. It works for me. I wouldn't have it any shorter.
It's quite an unusual thing, I think, for that time to do this in a film. Nowadays, we're used to seeing chases that last for half an hour in a Bond film or in Mission Impossible. But this was really sort of confounding expectations of audiences at the time.
Well, they stop off at old Sheriff Bledsoe's for him. Well, this is an interesting scene.
This scene.
Why?
Because the sheriff... Well, because if you weren't getting the theme, which you could be forgiven for not getting because it's a bit slow and all the rest of it, he's here to tell you what's happening. So your time is up. You're going to die. And they can't get their head around it. So it's saying, yeah, like you said, this era is over and you need to change or you're going to die. But it's probably too late for you to change anyway. So it was good because it helped me... like reconfigure. Oh, right, okay, I am right for thinking that, because otherwise what is this film about? Because it's not really a Western in that traditional sense. And it's just it's funny as well. Like, it's played for laughs, like him trussing him up and like, put that thing in my mouth because I'm the sheriff and you can't be in here and all the rest of it. So I just liked it because it solidified for me what this film was actually about.
I like the lack of subtlety in the foreshadowing, because he says, you're going to die bloody and all you can do is choose where.
Yeah.
And that's the next hour of this film.
Yes.
But it does also motivate them to get the hell out of Dodge and get to Bolivia because they don't want to die. And so they are like, right, where can we carry on?
Where can we be us? So I was interested to find out that the Bolivia thing was real, because from a 1960s odd lens, people in, someone from the US would have said Bolivia was less, in quotes, developed than the US, right? So do they go to Bolivia, when I thought it was purely fictional, because Bolivia is, quote, marks, less developed. So their shtick still works in Bolivia, which obviously it does. So they're running away from, quote, marks, progress and capitalism and this sort of endless progress that was part of... That's why the bicycle is so important, because Butch throws the bike away. He doesn't get it. He doesn't get what that thing could do for him.
They're running away from photographs and phones and wires because this is what was going to catch them, because at the turn of that century, law enforcement suddenly became more sophisticated. And it's actually what meant they had to leave as well, because the famous photograph we've got of the Hole in the Wall gang, who were also the Wild Bunch, that was the other name for that gang, and they changed the name here because the Wild Bunch came out that year. But we've got that famous photograph of them dressed up as dandies, which they sent to their families, and the Pinkertons got hold of it.
Yeah,
and their photo was in every shop window and every bank.
They didn't get it. They thought it was hilarious to have their photograph taken. Like, no, because these new forces of progress. But also, it's also because when they try, again, jumping ahead slightly, when they try to go straight, so you can also read it as like capitalism in terms of like quote unskilled labor will never pay, because they do try a little bit of going straight and it doesn't work for them. So it's like the idea that with progress also comes like quite tricky labor situations and maybe the cushion of unions and things like that. So that's in the mix as well. Like they try to do it the right way and it doesn't work, because the right way actually is a rigged game anyway.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Have some of that.
I'll take that. Thank you. Thank you. That was a lovely meal. I enjoyed that. I like the bit where Bledsoe apologises at the end. After going, you're going to die bloody. You just get to decide where. He goes, I'm sorry, I'm getting mean in my old age. Yeah. It's really touching, because you feel like in a very short scene, without anyone explicitly saying it, that they have had this long relationship with this guy. So we get the big jump off the cliff. It's the bit I remember from a kid, because it's like one of about two stunts in the whole movie. There's really not a lot of action in this movie. I'm surprised I quite enjoyed it as a kid.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the coolest things I'd seen when I was a kid. And now it just looks a bit dated, because we're used to seeing a car flying from one scraper to another in Fast and Furious. But this was the equivalent of that then. Like Goldman talks about the fact that that brought the house down. Seeing your two heroes jump off a cliff like that, you hadn't seen stunts like that before. So it looks quaint now, but it's still funny hearing them swear. I think it was one of the first times I heard swearing in a film as well, which was quite exciting.
It says a bit about their characters as well. That's what I like about that scene. You know, kind of the resolve that they have together and the way they're sort of joshing each other, but encouraging each other, and also literally taking the plunge. So yeah, I agree. That scene works for me.
Apparently the other scene that people were like, whoa, was when Butch, at the very start, when he's fighting Logan, kicks him in the balls, because your Western heroes up until that point had never fought dirty. It was just unheard of that someone would do that. And so people gasped in the theatre and then sort of burst out laughing, because this was so new to them.
That's what I'd do as well.
Totally what I'd do.
Yeah.
100%.
So if we fought each other, we'd just be trying to kick each other in the balls for 10 minutes.
Such an image.
Just scrapping in the dust. Just little legs flailing.
He's got big legs.
Oh, he does have
I'd get him first.
Yeah, he'd just keep me at distance.
Look at my Chelsea boots. Look at that point. Yeah. Right in there. Right in your gooch. Right then, good, let's move on. So they decide to go to Bolivia. They've decided, like, Butch is furious that this super posse is chasing them and will never stop. He says about Ed, E.H. Harriman, if he'd just pay me what he's spending to make me stop robbing him, I'd stop robbing him. So they're off to Bolivia. They chuck the bicycle away, very symbolic, as you said, and they take Etta with them, as long as she doesn't whine at all. There are some conditions.
So do you think, Anna, I'll ask you, do you think he's teasing her? Because they establish a woman is good cover. So basically, if she doesn't go with them, they're screwed. It's not going to work. So then when Sundance says to her, but, you know, you can come on, if you whine or if you make a nuisance, which is like, right, okay. That's you being aggressive and mean. But is that actually because the type of man he is, he's begging her help, but he can't be seen to be begging. And she knows that he's begging because they have that sort of relationship. So that's why she doesn't go, can you not talk to me like that? Or I'm not going to come. Like, you need me. And I read it like that the first time. But then when she's basically like, I have nothing and I'm no one. So yeah, I'm definitely in. And it's like, oh, Etta, come on. Like, you've got loads going for you. You've got your own house. These guys have been troubling you. They're going now. So that's fine. You've got a nice job. But so it undercut my first reading of it, which was, in the parlance of their relationship, he's pleading for her help in the only way he knows how. So he's not actually threatening her with being, you know, whining and making a nuisance.
I think that's quite a generous interpretation. I mean, I think I feel that that could work in a different film with a little bit more detail about their relationship. We've seen so little about their relationship at this stage. And I also smarted when she says, I'm 26. My life's basically done. Yeah. You know, you guys are the most exciting thing that's happened to me in ever. It's sort of quite depressing. And obviously, it says something about the times. But at the same time, and the fact that I found it very offensive when he says, you know, you can't talk, you can't complain, come along. And then the fact that she acquiesces, I think, undermines any suggestion that you said that it might be a joke, because she just says, that's fine, I'll button up. Yeah. You know, and that would have been a very hard journey for anyone at that time.
Oh, no, don't forget, she does offer to do their cleaning and to do their
sewing. Oh, the cooking and everything. Yeah. And the whole
So she's going to have loads of fun, actually.
Works.
So
it'll be so much fun for her.
I think so, So I get it now. I get it. Great. Okay, but carry on.
Do you not think that's how we would have spoken to her? And do you not think those are the kind of things she would have done?
She would have done those things. A woman would have, I guess. I mean, who knows? I think the other thing to throw into the mix, which kept me on the hook both times, is the idea of this unrequited relationship between Butch and Etta. So they talk a lot about when they're on the... I mean, the bike thing, that to me is a couple, like having fun. Mm. And then one of them says to the other, do you think it could have been different if we'd met each other first? So that's really interesting, because Butch and Sundance are best friends and they've got this woman in the middle, but it doesn't seem to cause any acrimony, which is interesting. And I wondered if she goes on the journey because she's like, well, if you keep talking to me like this, I've got this ace up on my sleeve. So, and he's lovely.
Have you seen his eyes?
Have you seen his blue eyes? So it's kind of fine. If Sundance, you know, sort of fulfills on that promise of being a bit of a dick, there's always Butch, if that's what she wants, kind of thing.
Yeah, there is a suggestion throughout of that kind of love triangle or even threesome, I think, really.
I think it's a threesome. Yeah, I do think that, especially during the photo montage.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and when he's watching them dance on the boat.
Yeah, and he looks sad, but he also looks like, it looks like an even thing. It looks like the three of them are happy with the relationship as it stands. And then again, later when they're in Bolivia and they've got adjoining rooms, they're really comfortable with that. And that to me is like they are all maybe sleeping together at some point.
I'm right in thinking that's something that Goldman made up. I don't think there's any evidence.
In real life, Butch Cassidy's family, when he wasn't called Butch Cassidy, were thought to be part of a secret underground railroad of groups of people that sheltered polyamorous members of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. So he may, unproven, but he may have been around polyamorous groupings in his life. So maybe that's in there, the idea of a throuple is not so alien to him.
Yeah, and I read that some people say that she was with him first and then moved on. So
interesting.
But also that you do see that the two men are very comfortable with each other sexually. You know, one's in bed with a hooker and the other one's just in the same room, just chatting away. Yeah. So there's that intimacy is already there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of suggestions and very funny moments, I think, that we see that suggested that. And to me, actually, that's one of the highlights of the film, is that suggestion and that idea that the three of them are somehow emotionally, if not romantically, entwined.
Yes. Mm.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very unique thing for a film to have, like this setup between these two guys and this woman. I didn't really get it as a kid. The bit where he's riding on the bicycle with her, and we've seen her with Sundance at this point, Etta, and when Sundance sort of goes, you can have her, and walks back into the house, as a kid I was like, oh, wow.
Yes. This is how it works.
This is how it works, genuinely.
This is like, what's wrong with films like this.
Sure. At 9 years old, I was like, he's just given her away to... Yeah, but that's what it was to me. I was like, he's gone, you can have her. And I think that was how it worked.
And that's why you still do that to this day.
This is why
trading
films,
women.
Yeah, women are property in films. And on a serious note, and a young kid watching a film like that doesn't get the nuances of that.
Yeah.
And that's
why Alex is broken to this day.
Shut up. Right. So they're off to Bolivia. I'm going to be completely honest with you. I don't remember a single second of this third act from when I was a kid. Mm. I remember it now, but as a kid, it just, there's nothing memorable about it. It's very strange. But then I like the chase sequence. I felt the tension and things sort of seem to really slow down here. And I enjoyed it more this time, obviously. I enjoy the fact that they have to learn Spanish to rob a bank. I thought that was a hilarious conceit. And I like watching, even though it's done in, without any dialogue, the scene where Sundance and Etta rob the bank by with it. You like, you can tell from what they're doing that she's going, I don't trust this bank. And he's like, come in, see the safe.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And leads them downstairs. Only
that's
one thing.
There was no evidence that Etta was involved with any of their robberies when William Goldman wrote this script. So that's something that he made up. Mm. And then a few years later, they found evidence that she was involved in one of the robberies. So
it's quite an enigma, though. Like, nothing's known about her. Like, the last sighting of her, or the last sighting of the person who was thought to be her, was when a woman walked into an office, a government office in America, and requested Sundance's death certificate. And I think that was like 1904, maybe, and that was it. And so you don't know, no one really knows what happened to her.
Because I think Peace wasn't her last name, her real last name, and so they can't find any, they don't know where to start looking for records for her. Mm.
Well, what the film cut out was obviously because it would be quite boring to watch them running a ranch in Argentina for about 6 years before they started robbing again. They had quite a nice life living together, apparently, the three of them running a ranch.
So they did have other options. They didn't have to go back to robbing. I'd have liked to have seen that. Actually.
No, which is interesting, isn't it, when we get to that? Because they try and go straight and it doesn't work out. And you can tell that they're going to go back to robbing after they try and become payroll guards in that whole sequence for the mines. And this is where Butch actually kills someone for the first time, and he says it in the film. He goes, I've never killed anyone before, which is true. That was, in reality, despite being the leader of this outlaw gang, the first time he ever actually killed another man was the bandits in Bolivia.
Yeah, so I think their decision was, going straight is the first time we've had to murder people, we may as well go back to our old life, because this isn't worth it. What is the point?
Which is when Etta tries to convince them there are other ways of going straight. The campfire scene, and she's like, there's farming. And it's...
But she doesn't try too hard. And then that was another like negative thought for me with their relationship, because she doesn't talk. When she's teaching them Spanish to rob banks and she's robbing banks, she's on equal footing kind of with them because she's part of the gang and she's very useful and all the rest of it. But then when it comes to the crunch, it's like, right, this isn't going to work. What are we going to do? She's sort of like, well, we could try farming. And they're like, no. And then she's like, right, okay, bye. And I wondered if she was holding her tongue because she didn't have the power that I'd sort of projected onto her. Because if she spoke too sharply or too forcefully, the men would either tell her to shut up or just ignore her. So she's like, what's the point? So I'm going to go.
I think it's more, it's a lost cause. I think she realises at this point that they have made that decision already. They are going to go back to robbing. So her words are falling on deaf ears.
She can see the writing on the hole in the wall.
Nice.
Oh.
Lovely.
Got that written down.
So I tried to find out exactly how it all fitted together. And I think it's this, because I think this scene replaced an earlier scene. So the footage at the start of the train robbery, originally there was a scene here, which is Butch and Sundance in Bolivia watching that footage.
Yeah,
that newsreel
footage.
The actual footage?
Yeah.
Only what was at the start of the film?
No, the deleted scene.
Oh, is it in there?
It's on the DVD.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, so they go to the cinema with Etta when cinemas were new. I mean, it's a tent with a screen, and they see historical figures of that time that puts them in a kind of context for the audience. But then they see film of themselves on screen. And suddenly they have something to live up to because they've seen that they've become these legends. And they get annoyed that what they're seeing on screen is wrong. And then they see themselves get killed in this footage. And it comes up in Spanish, the inevitable. And so that's the moment that Etta departs on her own. And so while they're watching themselves die, she's leaving and heading to the train station. And so the reason he'll cut it is because he felt like it was too much of a contrivance. He didn't buy it when he was watching it. And he does commentary over it saying, I just don't buy this. But I think it's interesting just showing us that these two people were the first people to experience fame in their own lifetimes in this way. And so it was kind of underlining that, but I think it's a really good scene. I think he's wrong, but yeah, he thought it was clumsy.
It sounds a bit abrupt, her leaving, though, because I do quite like the conversation she has with Sundance and Butch, where she's like, I think I'm thinking about leaving. And he's like, well, it's up to you. And when they're lying by the campfire, there's at least a conversation about it. By all accounts, this scene, she just sort of watches them shouting indignantly at the screen about how they're portrayed. And it's like, I've had enough, and walks out.
I thought it came after the campfire scene, though. Well, but I might be wrong, because it doesn't actually say where it appeared. But yeah.
Okay. Well, as it turns out, she left at the right time, because things are going to go fucking awful. We know what's coming now, because Etta's gone, and she said, I won't watch you die. So they're going to die. And sure enough, we're into the final shootout with the Bolivian cavalry. They're still bantering about going to Australia. And I told you I had a question about this. at the, and William Goldman talks about this being like one of the finest scenes he's ever watched performed. Redford and Newman in the scene is like the way they are. It's fantastic. Do they know they're going to die? And is it like, and it's just a little bit of like saving face with each other and having a, like pretending it's going to be okay? Or do they actually think they're going to make it out of this situation?
I think they know they're mortally wounded. I think this is them.
Okay. Do they see the army outside?
No, that's why I think they think they might still
get
out.
They might make it alive. Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Because they don't know the army's turned up. And again, like Hill, the director, talks about the Bolivian cavalry. He was like, it's unbelievable that this would happen, but it did actually happen. By all accounts, it didn't happen. It was a shootout with a much smaller number of soldiers and the Bolivian cavalry didn't turn up.
But they go out and come back.
Yes.
Because they go, so they see there's they're absolutely surrounded, but when they're driven back.
They see a lot of men there, but the actual cavalry, the military arrive while they're talking amongst themselves inside. So they don't know that there's literally now about 100 men out there. They think there was like 10 or 20 or something.
Because that scene when they go out to, there's a mule that falls in that scene. And this was another uncomfortable thing in that documentary, because in America, you weren't allowed to do that stunt. But in Mexico, where they shot it, you were.
Why?
Because it was illegal to use a wire to trip a mule in America. But in Mexico, those rules didn't happen. So Hill, as he's commentating over this scene, he says, there's a chance of breaking the animal's neck with this technique. But luckily, we didn't.
Jeez.
It's like, wow. Well, different times.
The earliest scene where, on the subject of animals, the earliest scene when they're with the bull... And the bull chases.
I was waiting for you to bring this up.
Chases him when he's on the bicycle. That bull was called Bill. Yeah. Bill the Bull in real life. A very, very placid animal by all accounts. And they couldn't get it to chase the stuntman who was playing.
How did it pass the audition? I don't understand.
I don't think they auditioned it, but they found it. They found a workaround, as you would, which was to spray its testicles with hot sauce. And the hot sauce burnt its testicles to the extreme that it went mad and chased people.
Yeah.
Didn't it chase the person that sprayed it?
They said if you pointed in a direction and then squirted this on the balls, it would then charge in the direction they pointed
I don't fancy that job. They can kick backwards. No.
Classic
right.
Bill.
We get the end. They talk about Australia and how they're going to go there and it's really, really sweet. And then they die. They get shot. Well, we don't see them get shot. And as I said, as a 9-year-old, they definitely survived somehow. Because why wouldn't they? They're the heroes of this story. But chances are they probably died.
Mm.
Although in reality, as you'd imagine, a lot of confusion, mysteries afoot as to whether they did die. Because they never took photographs of the two men. Two men were killed in a shootout with the Bolivian army. And what happened was... it was much fewer men, but there was a shootout that erupted. It happened in the same way. They found this branding on the mule, knew it had been stolen from a mine, found these men, realised they were the men who'd robbed the miners in the jungle. And so a shootout began. And there was a break in the firing at about 2 a.m. and they heard a man screaming. And then they heard 2 gunshots. And the following morning they went in and found 2 dead bodies. And it was 2 men who'd been mortally wounded. And as the story goes, Sundance had been shot by Cassidy through the head to kill him because he was dying. And then Butch Cassidy had turned the gun on himself and killed himself. And that is how they died in reality, if it was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But you'd imagine...
Which would have been a different ending.
A really, really, really different ending.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see why they didn't do that ending.
Yeah.
I struggled with the ending as is. That would have broken me.
It doesn't really chime with raindrops keep falling on my head, does it?
A bit much for a 9-year-old as well.
Murder suicide, finish on.
But you touched on this. Weirdly, the town where this shootout happened still restages the shootout to bring in tourists.
Which version?
The movie version.
Okay.
Yeah, not the suicide pact version. So they have tried to dig up the bodies and they found no one in the cemetery where apparently they were buried that has the same DNA as the Cassidy relatives. So some people, like Butch Cassidy's sister, do claim that he returned to the US. There's so many different stories, but your real historians go, they definitely died down there in Bolivia. And that's about it. There's a remake in the works with Paul Rudd as Butch Cassidy and Tom Hardy as Sundance, and that's your lot.
Is there?
No.
That was good.
I'm right. I was like, I thought I'd do that at the end. And then I thought, actually, if you were casting those two roles.
But Tom Hardy's not right.
He's Tom Hardy?
Enough. He's not funny enough.
Paul Rudd is completely right.
Okay. Yeah. I thought Tom Hardy was better than Rudd.
Funnily enough, Paul Newman didn't want to play Butch Cassidy because he said, I'm not funny. I can't be funny. And it was George Roy Hill who convinced him that he could make it work. But it is interesting then, I was thinking about Paul Newman. He didn't do a lot of humorous roles in his career. He knew that that wasn't his thing. I think he is funny here, but...
Mm.
Yeah, so maybe it's Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy did do that romantic comedy with Chris Pine.
Oh, This Is War.
Yeah. So maybe not his thing.
Exactly my point.
Any more for any more?
No.
Shall we do the bits?
Yeah.
All right then. Best scene. We'll start with you, Chris.
Okay, I'm going to go with the ending, but as much really about, not as much about the final image, but I love that moment of those moments of them talking in that room and all the humour and hope and pathos and that faith that they have. I just think it's really beautiful acting. And then, of course, it's then buttoned by the freeze frame of them, that sort of end of innocence and them staying forever young in our minds. And, you know, the opposite of the Bonnie and Clyde ending, but no less powerful, I think, and no less effective.
I was surprised I didn't cry. I really thought I was going to cry at that bit, but I didn't, which goes back to what you were saying about it's strange that I'd loved these characters throughout. So in theory, I'm the perfect person to have that gut punch of emotion at the end when they die. And it didn't happen for me.
You know why I didn't cry watching it this time was just thinking about this version of the story that they've shown on screen, how many innocent people they've shot and killed in the 2 minutes before.
Exactly.
And I don't know what happened in real life, but then at that point, they're killing all these, rather than give themselves up, they're killing all these people who are innocent. Therefore, they deserve to die. The bastards.
Mm. Yeah. V, best scene?
I nearly chose the montage, the steam passage to Bolivia, because I just think it looks brilliant.
Based on real photographic evidence of the three of them in New York.
Even the
bit where they're in Tiffany's, like there is evidence that Sundance and Etta went into Tiffany's and bought like a pendant and a pocket watch.
That was based on the Pinkertons were following them round. And so they've got all these notes of where and when they went.
And I just like to see them like having the best of everything. Like if you were going to rob everyone, you might as well spend it, and you don't see that. And like, you know, when they're in Bolivia and the big platter of food they're having, I just liked all that. But obviously it's the ending, because just the endless quipping, it's annoying at points, but I quite like that. So that's it.
All right, ending. Anna?
I like the polite robbery that we spoke of. I like the fact Etta's got some agency in that scene. Exciting. And they're all dolled up, but it's also very funny. And I think the bank robber's actually, the bank teller is very funny. His reaction, where he's just going, here you go, ladies and gentlemen, do come and have a look at this mother. He thinks he's in for a winner, you know, a lovely new client. And then, the gun comes out, and it's just sort of that look of dejected sort of acceptance on his face, I think says so much about, you know, how common it was then. He was like, oh, here we go, another bank robbery. So yeah, I like that.
And the fact that he passes them the padlock back through the bar so they can actually lock him in. It's great. It's great. Mine is Butch's introduction, the fight with Logan, and especially Sundancer's shit-eating grin when he waves at him. I was giggling to myself. I thought it was great. Okay, Victoria, MVW, most valuable whatever.
So I think the actors, it have to be Paul Newman or Robert Redford, because Catherine Ross isn't given enough to do. So, and then I think Paul Newman and Robert Redford are fairly evenly matched. So Paul Newman is going to edge it for me as the character of Butch Cassidy, because I think the character of Butch Cassidy is slightly more interesting in this film because of the fight with Logan, like the way that he fights dirty, and also that he apparently has never shot anyone, which I cannot believe. But and then when it comes as it does, and actually Thelma and Louise does this a bit, it seems like more symbolic than real by that point. But fine, if it was true, he never shot anyone. And also this love triangle thing with Etta, like not taking what he seems to want, which during the time that this is set and shot, actually, that would have been hard for an audience to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And the endless annoying quipping, which I quite like.
I like that as well.
I know you do.
MVW, Anna?
I'm going to go for the animals. I was going to highlight Bill, but you've already told that story. But the horses also do a fantastic job. And you couldn't make this film without them, could you?
No.
So they do.
That's
a great job.
Good shout.
Yeah. It is. And it is a shame that they used a wire to trip a mule. I didn't know that. And the hot sauce on Bill's balls.
I nearly didn't bring that up because I thought it's horrible. Yeah. But we've got to tell the truth. That's what we do.
Couldn't do that anymore. Chris, MVW?
I think this film looks beautiful. And director of photography, Conrad Hall, really captures the colour and beauty of the Old West. And interestingly, I'd already picked him for watching one of the documentaries, but Paul Newman says he remembers George Roy Hill saying a few weeks in, "I'll stage it and you shoot it," as he knew what he was getting was gold. So Conrad Hall directed as much of this as Hill did on set.
It is a beautiful looking film.
Yeah.
Really beautiful. Well, I mean, I couldn't pick between Redford and Newman, so I think I'm going to give it to a man. And I'm trying to separate this film from reading his book, and I really struggle to separate just this script from that book, because that book talks about this film and it also talks so much about screenwriting. But I feel like I understood like structure of like screenwriting and like fell in love with dialogue from watching this movie and reading his book. So they've kind of meshed together, but it's William Goldman. And if I'm sure you've read Adventures in the Screenwriting Trade. It's just, if you've read it, V, it's...
I'm not very good with my theory. I'm just good at the writing.
Yeah, but it's just a gift.
It's something you can't teach. No, you can teach it. You absolutely can teach it.
But what's good about that book as well is it's got lots of good gossip in it as well.
Yeah. I did read it at college, but I've never read it since. And I don't refer back to it.
Well, he's my MVW anyway.
Fine.
So suck it up. Finally, change. What would you change about this movie? Anna, would you like to go first?
How long have you got?
Wow.
A lot of things. I mean, of course, I would change the representation of the women. But I'm going to say, for fun, I would amp up that threesome action. And let's see them all actually in bed together, consummating it. Let's do it.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. I'll jump in now because this isn't mine, but I thought as a nod to Thursday's films, it would have been nice if Sundance and Butch kissed just before they ran out. Just a little kiss.
Yes.
Just a little kiss. But mine is, well, Robert Redford thought it was crazy and killed the movie, but audiences loved it. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. I agree with Robert Redford and I disagree with the audience. I hate it. That song drives me mad. I think the movie grinds to a halt when it happens. It's one of the most famous scenes. It was a huge hit. People love it. I don't like the scene. I don't like the song. And it was someone else who was good at riding bikes. Not that it was in the film, because at the time they thought Butch was a bike riding trickster. And it turns out it was another cowboy. They found out afterwards. So it's incorrect. Just get rid. Sorry, I know it's romantic and people love it.
But I really hated that song as well. I remember it, but I hated
it. I liked it when I was a kid and now I can't bear it.
Mm. Sorry. B.
So Etta, she's a school teacher ostensibly in this film, which is a respectable business back in the day, right? Mm. But she goes and she abandons her job without telling anyone, which wouldn't be the done thing to do. And she goes on the run. Now, she doesn't make it onto the wanted posters, even though she's robbing banks. So she can, in theory, slip back into her life with a bit of finagling about where she's been. So I would have liked to have seen what happened to her just for a moment when she gets back home, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Mine's really simple. It's the bit where they're being chased by the police in Bolivia and they reach a junction in the road, the police do, and they ask a little farmhand, they're like, which way have they gone? And he points them down a road and they ride past Butch, the trio, hiding in some ruins. And I'm just like, the whole thing is like they've recaptured what they had back in the States. So I think it would have been good if they recreated the sweet face moment from earlier where they'd actually paid that guy to send the guys the wrong way and they appeared behind him and gave him a thumbs up or gave him some money and rode off in the opposite direction, because then you get a nice repeat of sweet face.
Set up and pay off, Alex.
Yeah, exactly.
Better than Goldman.
I'm getting rid of it. Robert Redford can be my MVW. I've just realised. Not Goldman. Not after that. right then. I think that's done. And just so we don't have any awkwardness in the studio, Chris has dropped the quiz this week. It's not from me, it's from you. He doesn't want to see you get that competitive in front of a guest. But we can tell you about something, because you are doing the London Podcast Festival as well as us. Anna, tell us about your night.
Yeah, so we're going to do it on the 9th of September. We've got Ita O'Brien, who's the intimacy coordinator, coming on to talk about her work and some other surprise guests. So it should be really fun. I did London Podcast Festival a couple of years ago. Great audience. So hope to see people there. And I look forward to seeing your one as well.
Great stuff. Yeah, it's our first one. And we ummed and ahed and discussed what movies we were going to do. And in the end, we decided to run a poll on our Twitter account.
We wanted to go highbrow, didn't we?
Oh,
we were thinking, let's take this seriously. Mm. We want to do two films that we can really get deep with.
It was like, it was going to be Butch and Sundance, but we'd already committed to doing that with Thelma and Louise this week.
We went through the Oscar winners. Mm. And
So I'll just read through the movies that were on the poll, and then Chris can announce who the winner is, because we put it up on Twitter. If you don't follow us on Twitter, I do bang on about following us on Twitter a lot. So if you've missed out on voting, I'm sorry. And if you come into the live show and you're like, I'm coming to see what? Show and fault. Follow us on Twitter at ClashPod. You had four options: Wild Wild West versus Lost in Space, Masters of the Universe versus Michael Bay's Transformers, Super Mario Brothers versus Sonic the Hedgehog, and Howard the Duck versus 1990s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Hundreds of votes were counted, and it was bloody close. Mm. But Chris, we have a winner. What two films are going head-to-head at the London Podcast Festival?
We're
going
to spend a lot of that night talking about interspecies sex, because Great. We are doing Howard the Duck and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
You're welcome, London.
No, I love it. I love it. I'm very excited. You can get tickets on the website or follow us on Twitter, where all the details are at Clash Pod. Right then, quick clue for next week's choices before we come back on Thursday to talk about Thelma and Louise. It's my choices next week. Here is your clue. What a helmet. No wonder the movie tanked. That's your clue. What a helmet. No wonder the movie tanked. That's my clue for the movies we're doing next week. We'll be back on Thursday. Anna, you're coming back, aren't you, to talk Thelma and Louise?
I cannot wait.
Excellent stuff. In the meantime, please subscribe, rate, and indeed review us if you have the time. It's a great help. And check in with us on Twitter and Instagram at ClashPod. Back on Thursday. Bye-bye.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.